This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. This past summer, Jaws of Justice Radio aired two programs dealing with the effects of alcohol on individuals and our community. On our third installment, host Keith Brown-L returns with Dr. Sabu Sarma, a psychiatrist with 10 years of experience in psychiatry and psychosomatic medicine. After one of those previous broadcasts, Liz Henry emailed us asking to come on and tell her personal story of alcohol addiction, how that addiction affected her life, and how she took control once again. Host Lee Moore will talk with Liz in the second half of our show. Coming up in the final two shows of 2013, we will address domestic violence and sexual assault next week. Then on our final show of 2013, a panel of local lawyers will recap the legal news of the year, and we open the phone lines for your nominations of Story of the Year. At the end of the show, as always, the 420 Drug War News. Now to Keith and Dr. Sarma.
Good morning, sir. My name is Keith Brown-L. I'm from 90.1 FM KKFI Community Radio. Could you please tell us who you are and what you do?
My name is Sabu Sarma, and I'm a psychiatrist in the Kansas City area.
And you are employed or research medical?
Or you we have contracts with Research Medical, and we see inpatients and consultations there. Mm-hmm. But I'm part of the practice called Midwest Psychiatric Consultants.
And what does that entail?
Well, we have an office in Lee's Summit where we have a small outpatient practice, but the main practice of our group is hospital consultations. An internist, intensive care unit doctor, a surgeon has a question for us, medical unit, intensive care unit, and we come in and give a psychiatric consult and then, when appropriate, follow the patient as they're in the hospital.
And how long have you been in this profession?
Approximately 10 years.
Okay. Have you had an occasion to deal with people who have alcohol problems?
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about alcohol and the type of problems that it causes, what it does to your mind, your body, and concerning the communities that people live in?
Well, we all know that alcohol is around, and actually when I was in grade school, high school, some of the states still had the 18-year-old legal limit for drinking. So I grew up in the Chicagoland area, and people could go across the state to Milwaukee or just the southern border of Wisconsin. If you were 18 there, you could have a beer. So alcohol has been around for ages. It's not going anywhere. I don't think we're going to have another prohibition era again. At least I'd be really surprised if that came about.
Well, I live in an area where they have a lot of people who partake in alcohol, and sometimes it makes me feel like prohibition may not be a bad idea. Maybe this time it'll work, but it doesn't look like it's coming anytime soon. So I'm just trying to get information out to people and let them know maybe they can somehow find the fortitude to abstain from it themselves.
If you're 21, it's legal. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're doing something that's not illegal makes a lot of people think, well, I'm okay. And the other thing with alcoholism, there are a lot of functional alcoholics out there. People who come home after work and have 12 beers, 24 beers, sometimes a whole fifth of hard alcohol. But they've always made it to work the next day, haven't had any big marital problems yet, or at least their spouse hasn't confronted them aggressively, haven't had a DWI because it's all at home, no medical issues that they're aware of, they haven't had a abdominal swelling, dark tarry stools, they're not aware of any liver disease, so they think they're doing okay, and yet they're a functional alcoholic.
And also endangering their mental health.
Absolutely.
Out of all the different brands of alcohol that they have, in your experience, what do you think are the ones that's the most harmful to people?
Well, I think probably hard alcohol.
Mm-hmm. What would that be?
It would be your standard gin or vodka and anything that's, you know, 80 proof or higher. Though, you know, we've certainly seen some people get into trouble with beer and wine just on the sheer volume they're consuming.
Why do you think that the hard liquors or the gins and the other things are more harmful than the others?
Because they're more potent. Mm-hmm. They'll get you drunk quicker. You'll often have the higher blood alcohol levels.
And what type of effect does it have on the physical body?
It can certainly have a deleterious effects on the brain, the liver, and, you know, virtually every system, that the nervous system is particularly sensitive to the effects of alcohol. Not only the brain, but the entire nervous system. So I'm talking about your spinal cord, your peripheral nerves. You can get a neuropathy somewhat similar to diabetic, but it has more complex aspects as well.
What is that word you use again?
Neuropathy.
And you said it's similar to diabetes.
Now, these are later stage problems somebody would have after probably one decade or longer. So this isn't maybe to be confused with someone who's more in the acute stages of their alcoholism.
Now, what are the specific signs of alcoholism? What do you look for when you're trying to identify the symptoms?
Well, there's some screenings that have been around there for a while. One that's real popular and that we all learn in medical school is called CAGE. So C-A-G-E. And each of those letters refers to a symptom of alcoholism. And the C being, have you ever thought you needed to cut down on your drinking? The A being, do you get angry when people tell you you're drinking too much? Why are you drinking again? The G, have you ever felt guilty about your drinking? The fourth one, the E, is the eye opener. When somebody's having withdrawal symptoms in the morning, they're shaky, or they need that first drink to get going, even if it's just a Bloody Mary with a little bit of, you know, vodka or something, that still counts.
Well, some of the material that I've had a chance to consult on the subject, it says that some of the symptoms you experience are craving, which is a strong need to drink, loss of control, not being able to stop drinking once you've started, physical dependence, withdrawal symptoms such as nausea, sweating, sickness when you drink, tolerance, the need to drink greater amounts of alcohol to feel the same effect. Have you had patients that had those experiences?
On a real regular basis, we see all of those. And that's kind of how you know when your disease is progressing a bit. Are you starting to drink more than you used to? Well, what we do commonly see, though, is I think the point you raised that, you know, drinking more, kind of losing that sense of control over the drinking, and the alcoholic really can't socially drink anymore because they're not able to have one or two beers and go home or stop.
Has it been your experience that most people who become alcoholics are self-medicating because they've had some other problems that have led to the drinking? They've been traumatized by some type of event, other event in life, and the alcohol is somewhat of an escape for them?
I'd say a fairly significant period of the time. We'll find somebody who has sobered up and then they're starting to have some other problem, depression, insomnia, you know, something else will come back in a vengeance, and it's maybe somebody who I've only met a couple of times or seen them in the hospital. And it's kind of odd for them to present in with the constellation of symptoms they are in their 40s or 50s. And I ask them, well, you didn't have any problems like this in your 20s or 30s? And sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I was drinking every day then. I was drinking pretty heavily. So you're absolutely right. The drinking can mask other symptoms ranging from depression or anxiety to even psychosis.
Could alcohol be the cause of possibly the death of a loved one or something? You're going to a state of depression and or maybe a breakup in a relationship or things of that nature. Are those contributing causes to alcoholism?
They can certainly be contributing causes to somebody self-medicating with alcohol. And whether that'll really progress to alcoholism probably depends somewhat on their genetic susceptibility. It depends what other supports are around them that either nip the binge, so to speak, in the bud or let it progressing. I've had patients in their 50s who maybe pretty much toed the line throughout their life, and then, like you said, death of a loved one, some significant problem, and somebody in their 50s starts drinking, and after 2-3 years, they're up there drinking the same amount as a, you know, hardcore 2-3-decade alcoholic.
Is alcohol a disease that you remain in recovery for the rest of your life?
Addiction lasts a lifetime, really. Well, once you've pretty much hit the criteria for the diagnosis. And there's some specialists out there who say you're never really cured. The disease maybe goes into remission, but you're still an alcoholic. You're still a cocaine addict. You're still an opiate addict. And relapse, unfortunately, could be just around the corner.
Do you think that the availability of so many liquor stores in a certain location contributes to alcoholism or heavy drinking by the people who are in and around that area?
If you've got accessibility, if it's right around the corner, it makes it really hard. You almost need an AA group that's as close. So instead of going into a liquor store, you can go across the other street and go into an AA group.
You have a lot of people who grew up in a family where they constantly seen people drinking all the time. In my case, I grew up in a family like that. I don't drink or use drugs or anything, but I looked around and I seen, well, it was far too many people in my family that were alcoholics and drug addicts, and I guess I got lucky. I just looked around and I seen all that. I came to the conclusion, well, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, but I know I don't want to be none of that. But sometimes I think that it probably has the opposite effect. People grow up and they see this type of behavior as they're maturing and they were inherited as a part of life. And then they say that some people, it's just in their genes. If you have people that drink all the time in your family, then it's a good possibility that you may be an alcoholic. Now, which one of those two premises do you think is more likely?
Well, it's kind of like a chicken and egg question, and really, I think it is both. There is definitely a genetic contribution toward alcoholism, and there's a genetic contribution toward addiction, you know, no matter what we're talking about, cocaine, or pain pills. The addicted brain, there's a genetic component. It's really an organic sort of situation. I mean, certainly, to become an addict at anything, you have to work at it a little bit. You have to continue to use it. You have to be chasing that high. But the addicted brain gets turned on. The brain gets euphoria from the substance much, much quicker. And your genetics kind of set you up a little bit for it. Now, what you said I thought was a good point. I would say that there are probably more people who grow up around it or either used to it and end up using themselves, or from that genetic, you know, heritability, they end up using themselves. And the individuals like yourself who said, well, I saw everybody around me doing it growing up. I know I don't want to do that. It's probably less common.
And I'm not sure you didn't answer this question earlier, but what I wanted to ask you is that, do you think that the fact that alcohol is legal here in America, that's sort of like a contribution, where what I'm getting at is that a lot of people know that drugs are illegal. Even marijuana, I'm saying, is probably less harmful than alcohol is, but a lot of people, they will not engage in marijuana simply because it's illegal and you can go to jail. The fact that the government puts this seal of approval on alcohol, do you think that makes it more likely that people would prefer that over drug abuse, because they feel like if the government says it's okay to do it, then it must not be harmful?
You're probably onto something there, and we wouldn't get rid of alcoholism, but I would imagine if it was a substance that was illegal, if we went back to prohibition, we would see some decline in the rates, but we would probably see a rise in other problems then that we have, you know, with the drug trade. That would apply to alcohol, and you would have speakeasies again, and you would have organized crime controlling the distribution of alcohol. So you probably end up seeing some deaths and crime of a different nature.
Well, based on what you've seen as a doctor, do you think that the problems that would result from alcohol being made illegal justifies it being legal in the society, that there's less of a problem?
Well, that's a pretty controversial question. I haven't heard a lot of folks or clinicians arguing for prohibition in a while. Like I said, it's been around for centuries, actually longer, and it's a, you know, substance that can be handled responsibly.
Well, what in your definition is responsibly?
Responsibly would be somebody who doesn't drink when they're driving, somebody whose use is 1 to 2 a day at most. There are actually studies now that show that 1 to 2 a day, probably a max of 2 if you're a man, 1 if you're a woman, it actually has some health benefits. So it's actually what we call kind of a J-shaped curve when we're looking at mortality and morbidity.
I'm kind of suspicious when I hear people use that term responsible, because as you just pointed out earlier, you have a lot of people, they have serious alcohol problems, but you never know it until they get in trouble. And they've went on for years. If you look at the word responsible from that perspective, you may not agree with me, but I know crack cocaine users and heroin users and even PCP users who appear to be able to use that drug responsibly because they can engage in it without ever getting in trouble. And it's years before you know they have the habit, but before the law enforcement catches up with them or they end up in the hospital, you don't hear anything out of them. So, I mean, in a sense, I'm wondering if that's on the same level with responsibility.
Well, that's a good point. I don't think small amounts of alcohol are probably going to be intoxicating or impairing to the same degree as small amounts of other psychoactive drugs out there. That's why those drugs are Schedule 1. When we look at all the drugs, the FDA makes them a Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And pain pills, by and large, are either Schedule 2 or 3. Your Adderall, which kids and adults are on for attention deficit disorders, is Schedule 2. Your medicines like Xanax and Valium are Schedule 4. Cocaine, heroin, all of those are Schedule 1. meaning they're used in research, but really not shown to have any safe or beneficial value to humanity.
When we sat down and tried to discuss the subject of alcohol, one of the questions or the replies you always get is, well, you have large numbers of people who do behave responsibly when they drink alcohol, or they can have a few drinks and leave and go home. They don't drive drunk or things like that. It's not the people who know how to behave responsibly that create the problems. It's always the people who don't know how to behave responsibly. I have a statistic here that says there are about 18 million adults here in America that are alcoholics. Do you feel that the people who know how to behave responsibly justifies the legitimate use of alcohol as opposed to the problems that are caused by the people who don't know how to behave responsibly?
I don't think making it illegal would make those alcoholics lose access to it. Just like the people who want their heroin, cocaine, they're able to get it.
What would a person have to do to get a person that's an alcoholic into a program? Because from what I've understood about addiction, a person has to be willing to get into the program. You can't just grab them and drag them in there and say, you're going to do this whether you want it or not.
That's absolutely true. We involuntarily commit people to the inpatient psychiatric ward occasionally. That's somebody who's an acute risk to themselves or others, usually because of depression, a psychotic disorder. You can't forcibly, as a psychiatrist, lay person petitioner, put somebody into a rehab. Now, if he's an alcoholic and he has some kind of suicidal comment or an overdose or something, I can maybe put him on a psychiatric ward for a few days against his will. But, after that, as far as the actual rehab, it's really up to, up to the patient, the individual, to have that motivation to want to go through with it.
Is there anything that family members can do? I'm saying, as far as maybe sitting down. How would you sit down and have a conversation with a person? What are the things that you need to point out to them to make them realize, look, you are in trouble, you have a drinking problem, you need help?
It's probably going to be a series of conversations. You're going to kind of plant a seed and hopefully the seed will grow. A show of force never hurts, and that's probably one of the later stages where you do an intervention, so to speak. Get multiple friends and family members together that the individual likes, hopefully respects, and cares about, and prevents the situation. Look, you're hurting relationship with X and Y and Z, and you're really going down a bad path.
Well, is alcohol different from narcotics in that sense? Because a lot of times when people are addicted to narcotics, they just don't care. They stop caring about the family and everything. You can do all that, but he's like, look, this addiction is going to speak louder than anything anybody in this room can say to me, and when it starts calling me, I have to answer. Is alcohol different in that sense?
I think there's some similarities. The addiction to narcotics might be, I'm sure, it'll depend on the patient. They might have a different point of view than me. The narcotic addiction can be a bit stronger if you're going to try to compare addictions in this way. The narcotic withdrawal, you feel sick pretty quickly. That's what keeps the addiction going in part, is because the person doesn't want to go through that physical withdrawal. And there's psychological withdrawal with narcotics too, but the physical withdrawal, just such a bad flu, shaking, all this, that most people do whatever they have to do to start using again. The alcohol withdrawal, you don't feel as bad, but alcohol withdrawal can actually be life-threatening. So I would encourage anybody who is an alcoholic not to try to just detox themselves by stopping at home cold turkey, because you could have a seizure or you could have a profound serious withdrawal syndrome called DTs.
And, of course, this is the people who actually are in the stages of addiction, not just somebody who's drinking and going in the process of hangover or something, right?
That's true. Or somebody who drank 5 drinks a week or something for months, and they said, well, I'm going to take 3 months off. You're not going to go into withdrawal if you're drinking, 5 drinks a week. It's somebody who's upwards of 6 to 10 drinks a day, or you're high into your fifth of hard alcohol a day. I mean, we see that a lot of times when someone comes in the hospital for surgery, and they're here for 3 or 4 days, and they're real confused coming out of surgery, and it's beyond any kind of normal post-anesthesia confusion, and their family member comes in, and oh, yeah, he was drinking a fifth of alcohol every day for the last 3-4 years. Well, now he's in withdrawal.
That would be hard liquor, right?
Yeah, I mean, a pint of beer might not be enough to do it, but if you're drinking a case of beer, we've seen people on beer only who went into withdrawal, too. And the other group is people not in for surgery, but people who, well-meaning, said, I'm going to get this under control. I'm going to stop. I'm going to quit cold turkey. And they've got good intentions, and they do it, but they go into withdrawal and come in then with a seizure or DTs that I talked about earlier.
When I was younger, I was guess I was a little foolish like everybody else. I saw this stuff going on around me. I tried to start drinking, having a taste of alcohol here and there. The hangover was the worst part of it, and at that time I haven't drank anything in years, but the stuff that they had out there, it tasted terrible. I don't understand how people can get past those two things. It would seem to me that that would be enough deterrent right there, the taste of it and then the hangover. I mean, you have to be in a pretty deep state of depression to keep going back and inflicting that type of abuse on yourself to want to chase this high, don't you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think there are a lot of drugs out there, that substances out there, where you almost have to get over the hump sometime. Cocaine is not a drug like that. The large majority of cocaine users, the first time they used it, was actually one of the best highs. And there's such a thing they call chasing the dragon, where you're trying to get that high later and you just never quite get to it. But if somebody is predisposed to panic attacks and they use cocaine, they have a bad panic attack, maybe one of their worst panic attacks, they're never going to use it again, hopefully.
But that's not the case with alcohol, though, right? Is that a different set of circumstances, where the euphoria you feel from the first time you were ever intoxicated, that you never get that high again?
We don't see that with alcohol. But I also think we see with alcohol, people who've had a few hangovers or a bad experience, you know, might be prone to give it another chance. Mm-hmm. And then maybe it goes back to what we were saying, you know, that it was so accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people like smoking the first few times they do it. There might be another substance that you have to work at a little bit, and then some weeks, months in, it becomes commonplace and pleasurable.
Yeah, I tried that experience as well, and I couldn't get past that either. Is nicotine as addictive as alcohol, or is it more addictive?
Well, if you look at how difficult it is to quit, I guess somebody could argue that nicotine was the most addictive. But you also look at the age people start with some of these and variables like that.
I had a friend of mine who recently, they found him in a hotel room. He had died of alcohol poisoning. How much alcohol and what type do you have to consume to the degree that it might possibly be fatal?
Well, we all know, or hopefully I think we know, that the legal limit is 0.08% for driving a motor vehicle. And we routinely, you know, see people come into the emergency room 3-4 times that. What they told us in med school was that above 400 or 0.4, you know, you're looking at seizure, coma, death. And if you're above 500, you're getting into a level that's going to be often fatal for a number of people. I think that's maybe a good rule of thumb for kind of your college drinker, your high school drinker. A lot of these seasoned alcoholics out here can probably go close to 600 before they're going to have death. Because I've seen a lot of people in the emergency room with a blood alcohol levels above 500, which would be like 0.5 or, you know, about 6 times the legal limit for a car. Now, how much you have to drink to get there depends a little bit on how well the liver's working, what other medicines you have in your system, you know, that kind of thing.
Does your weight, age, or other things have a variable in that?
All those medical conditions can. People who've had different types of gastric bypass, they can sometimes tend to absorb the alcohol much more quickly. If you're drinking on an empty stomach as opposed to a full stomach, you're going to absorb things more quickly. There's actually shown to be a little bit of a risk for alcoholism with some of these gastric surgeries. Depression and alcohol are actually a pretty bad mix, too. Mm-hmm. I see a number of people who've had, you know, suicide attempts that if they'd been sober, they probably would not have had the attempt. Because you've got depression, and then you've got somebody with depression who's disinhibited. But the judgment is going to be impaired. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, why we have the legal limit for driving and that sort of thing.
I certainly appreciate the time you've spent with me today, and this has been an interesting interview, and for people that want to write in and find out more about it, and I do appreciate you you taking up your
time. Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, too, and hope I gave you something you can use.
Oh, you did, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, KKFI listeners. My name is Lee Moore, and you're tuned in to the Jaws of Justice radio show, which airs on 90.1 FM each Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Today, we're in our studio talking with Liz Henry on the subject of alcoholism. Ms. Henry, welcome to the Jaws of Justice radio show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, we all know we're in the midst of the holiday season. This is the time of year that many of us use to celebrate Christmas through our faith, fun, and families.
Unfortunately, however, there are also others who find themselves using this season to indulge heavily in alcohol. Today, we're honored to sit with you, Liz, to talk about your ideas on alcoholism. First of all, I'd like for you to give our listeners an idea of your history and your personal dealings with alcoholism.
I just want to say that I'm honored that you asked me to be here. I feel very fortunate to be speaking about this topic. I was an alcoholic for 16 years, an alcoholic and a drug addict for 16 years. And by the grace of God and many recovering people, I have been in recovery now for 13 years.
Hmm. And let me ask you if you could describe alcohol's impact on your family, friends, your career, your health, and your overall feelings of well-being.
When I was an alcoholic, I was a teenage alcoholic, and I was an alcoholic and a drug addict into my 20s. During that time, I didn't have much of a life. I went to school, and I functioned, but I was lost, and I created chaos in my life. I did things that I regret, that I can't take back. I've now, in recovery, I've come to learn the process I went through of being an, you know, the process of being an alcoholic and what happens to my mind and my body and my spirit. I'm glad that section of my life is over, honestly.
Now, in terms of your family, what were some of the things that impacted your family?
At that time, I didn't have my own family. I had my parents and my brothers. I created a lot of chaos for my family. I didn't have a great relationship with my family because I was using, I was drinking and I was using, and I had to hide it. So I had a dishonest relationship with them. And I just didn't see much of them. I just kind of created my own life with people that I could drink and use with and be around, you know, fellow alcoholics and addicts. And so I kind of grew apart from my family. And really during that time, I ended up dropping out of college because of my sickness. I still worked and I still had relationships, friendships and boyfriends. But I didn't create much of a life, much of a long-term life. I had, you know, dead-end jobs and I would quit and find another job. And eventually, towards the end of my alcohol use and drug use, I was homeless and I was jobless and I was penniless. I had no money. Thankfully, my parents agreed to put me into one inpatient treatment, and I feel grateful and fortunate that I went into that inpatient treatment, and from that point on, I've lived in recovery.
Hmm. Now, in your view, who can be defined as an alcoholic?
That's a hard one. I think most people have an idea that they either have a drinking problem or they are alcoholic. In my experience of during my alcoholism and in my recovery, I think most people have an idea if they rely on alcohol or other drugs to cope with the stresses of life. So I think that's so personal, but, you know, that's a personal understanding of yourself. But I think most people understand if they rely on alcohol to cope with the stresses of life.
How were you defined as an alcoholic?
I went into an organization called First Call. My dad took me there when I was 21, and I had an assessment. And you know, I look back and I think I must have been honest because during that assessment, they assessed me as an alcoholic and a drug addict. I didn't enter recovery at that time, but I was diagnosed. I do understand that now they have, you can go online, I think, and take assessments online that will assess you as either alcoholic or problem drinker. I do think they have that. I think they have that online now.
Okay. Now, since drinking alcohol can be so injurious to some people, why would you say it's so difficult for some people to stop drinking?
My understanding at this point in my recovery is that I think of alcoholism and drug addiction mm-hmm. as an illness. I think the illness develops actually pretty quickly if you have the genetic predisposition. And then I think the alcohol or the drug has hijacked your brain and has taken over. So I think the person is now kind of, the actual person is kind of out of the picture now. Now the drug or alcohol has taken over.
Hmm.
That's my understanding of it at this point. And then I think there's a whole system of enabling that person to stay sick.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now that that's a sickness as well. The people involved in that process of keeping the person sick, those people need to get healthy and need to stop supporting that person in their sickness. And that helps the person feel the consequences of their alcoholism or of their drug use. And that may be the key to them reaching out for help. And where I'm at in my recovery now, I understand. I've met people who have educated me about alcoholism. I've heard speakers, and I'm stealing this line from William Cope Moyers. He's got a great book called Broken, and he says there isn't a cure for alcoholism, but there is a solution.
Hmm.
So every day I choose to live in the solution.
Excellent. Now, being knowledgeable about alcoholism and addiction myself, how does the concept of codependence that you mentioned before, how does that contribute to an alcoholic's fate? How does codependence contribute to an alcoholic's fate?
In my opinion and my experience, if the codependents don't start taking care of themselves and get healthy, the alcoholic or the drug addict, their fate is sealed. They will die alcoholic or addicted.
Now, let's take a step back. How would you define codependency?
I see the codependent as somebody who, not necessarily maliciously supports the alcoholic or the addict, but just it's become a habit to support the alcoholic or the addict in their addiction. And so it can be a parent, a spouse, a friend, a coworker. So
and when you say support, what do you mean?
They might lend them money. They might call in sick for them. They'll cover up the chaos, the destruction that their alcoholism or addiction has caused, so that the person doesn't feel the consequences of that behavior.
So you think it's good for the struggling alcoholic or addict to feel those consequences?
Absolutely. I think if they do not feel the consequences, they will not reach out for help.
Good. Now, is there help available for those who can be considered codependent to an alcoholic or an addict?
Yes, there is. As I think I mentioned, I went into First Call when I was 21. My dad brought me there, and I was assessed alcoholic. And so after I got into recovery, I started volunteering for First Call. So First Call is a great organization in helping alcoholics, addicts, and codependents, and children of alcoholics and addicts learn about the disease. I took a great class there called How to Cope, and that helped teach me about the disease of alcoholism and the disease of codependency.
Now, hello, you are listening to the Jaws of Justice radio show on 90.1 KKFI. We're sitting here live in our studio talking with Liz Henry about the topic of alcoholism. Now, Liz, what are some of the things that friends, families, and coworkers and loved ones can do to help an alcoholic to recover?
I think a first step for the family and friends of an alcoholic or drug addict is to start taking care of themselves, to stop covering up for the sick person, to value their own mental and physical health. The codependent needs to take care of themselves and stop living in the disease with the alcoholic or the addict.
Are there programs for those who are involved in the lives of an alcoholic?
There is Al-Anon, and Al-Anon's a free program that is a mutual support group. The How to Cope class was a great class for me through First Call. And those are mainly to deal with my codependency issues. Those are two resources I've used.
Okay, excellent. Now, with this being the holiday season, would you say that alcoholism becomes a greater challenge in society? And if so, what are some of the ways our society can help reduce this great societal ill?
Yes, I think during this time, it becomes a huge challenge for people who are using and for people who are even recovering, because I think this time of year, everyone has these expectations of what life is supposed to look like and how to cope with the stresses of the season. And, I would encourage people to go, if you don't want to take that drink or you don't want to use that drug, you know, call First Call or go to a mutual support meeting and try and start talking through your problems instead of reaching for a medication, for a drug or an alcohol to help you deal with the stress.
Mm-hmm. Now, my personal dealings with alcoholism and addiction, I've learned that many tendencies can be handed down biologically. Now, how would you advise people who are dealing with offspring or of parents or have a strong family history of alcoholism or addiction?
I think the best thing I have done to learn about my family's genetic predisposition is going to mutual support meetings. I look up stuff online too, just to learn about the disease of alcoholism. There's help out there. There's meetings out there. It takes time, but there's a lot of recovery. There's a lot of support, and there's a lot of love around this city for people trying to recover. Hmm. It's an option. It's an option if you don't want to live in the misery of alcoholism and drug dependence. There's help.
Now, I've heard a comment that people who are in recovery are not bad people trying to become good, but sick people trying to get well. What's your comment on that?
I totally agree with that one. I like that one. I think in my journey, it's has made me very, very sad the way people with this illness are treated. I think they are good people trying to get well. I think they're sick people. And I think as a community, as a society, we have to start treating alcoholics and addicts with the same compassion that we treat people diagnosed with diabetes or heart disease or cancer, instead of looking at them as less than or morally corrupt. There's sick people that need help.
Now, your life without alcohol and without drugs, describe your life now.
My life now, after going through treatment and living in recovery, I completed my college degree. I met my husband. I got married. I have three children.
It's okay.
So, all that, our gifts of recovery.
Yes.
That I'm incredibly grateful for.
Yes. Now, one of the things you did mention during our private time was that you get a chance to sit with other moms in your area. Have you found any alcoholic issues among some of the moms that you're around?
I think that I notice in my I'm a stay-at-home mom and I homeschool my children, and I think I notice in this mothering community that I think women can reach for a bottle to try and cope with the stresses of motherhood. I don't know their diagnosis, but I know that for me and for my family, that's not the example I want to show my kids. I know it's out there. I know it's an easy, unhealthy way to decompress, I guess.
Sure. Now, one of the major issues with the new healthcare law is the fact that alcohol treatment for addiction is covered under the Affordable Care Act. Do you have any comments there?
I think that's great. I think this illness needs to be treated as an illness, and I think it needs to have the same benefits and compassion and care as someone diagnosed with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a great film called The Anonymous People, and there was a woman on there who was in recovery from addiction, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer. So then she had to go through everything related to breast cancer, and she was amazed at the kindness and the compassion and the support she received for her breast cancer. And it also made her kind of sad because that's not how she was treated recovering from alcoholism and addiction.
Now, you also mentioned earlier that there may be a constituency among the alcoholism community that's developing, that's trying to maybe get together politically. Comment there, if you would.
Well, I just learned a little bit about that from the film The Anonymous People. A woman brought that film to Leawood, and then First Call brought the film to the Tivoli last month, I think. And The Anonymous People educated me on the fact that, or just brought to the forefront of my mind, that recovering people are a huge constituency. And one of our responsibilities is to speak out and to not be ashamed of having this illness, and to use the numbers and the power we have to help the addicts and alcoholics that are still suffering, that instead of being sent to jail, they're sent to treatment.
Mm-hmm. Now,
because long run, that's best for all of us.
Sure.
If sick people become well and start living productive lives, it's better for all of us than sticking them in jails.
Sure. Now, in speaking of incarceration, I believe there's a large number of people who commit crime who, in fact, were either under the influence of alcohol or some sort of drug. What are your thoughts about incarceration versus treatment?
I'm a huge proponent of treatment, I think, and the film talked about that. I don't have a huge knowledge base on that, but the film talked about the fact that if you give people treatment in jails, then they're less likely to go out and commit more crime, because I think the sickness causes a lot of the crimes. I think the sickness causes abuse. So when you deal with the sickness, when you detox the humans, a lot of the other problems may naturally be resolved.
Now, how would you comment to someone who says, no, that person is simply making a choice to drink as opposed to not drink, and they're making a choice to commit a crime while they're under the influence? How would you comment to that person?
I have my understanding of the disease of alcoholism and addiction, and my understanding is that if you have the genetic predisposition, the disease takes over. And so I think that, and it's a brain disease, so I think that that person's brain is hijacked. And I think, like I said, they need to feel the consequences of their actions, but they need help and support in recovering and healing.
So you're saying that the brain of an alcoholic or an addict is different from the brain of someone else who doesn't feel the same effects?
I think it is. Because I think of my alcoholism and my addiction, and I think of going out and doing crazy stuff and waking up and being sick and having terrible hangovers, and I think something was wrong with my brain, because why would I think, oh, I'm going to do that again tonight, because it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't fun. I got arrested. I was sick. Why would I? A normal brain's not going to go, oh, wow, I want to do that again tonight and again tonight and again for 16 years.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Any final thoughts on the topic of alcoholism and addiction?
I think there's a lot of help, and I think there's a lot of support in this community. And if you want to try, even for a day, to stop drinking or to stop using, there's support, there's help. There's people who want to see you recover and live a happy, productive life.
Now, as we head into the holiday season, or head further into the holiday season, there's a rise in drunk driving accidents. We have police checkpoints where, unfortunately, a lot of people will be arrested for drunk driving. Unfortunately, people will leave holiday parties and under the influence of drugs or alcohol. People will be, unfortunately, taken to jail. People may not seek treatment. Sometimes they will repeat the same act. So you're proposing that we should all have compassion on these folk when, in fact, some may have accidents and hurt or kill people. That's kind of tough for us to have compassion on some of these people. Please comment.
Well, I would hope that I know for me, I got a DUI when I was an alcoholic, when I was in my active alcoholism. And unfortunately for me, it wasn't a wake-up call. It was maybe a little bit of a wake-up call, but I hope people see it as a wake-up call. Reach out for help.
You had some phone numbers. Please provide them in the last few seconds here.
First Call is a good hub for help. They can direct you to different mutual support groups. It's 816-361-5900. And I have the number to the KC Area Central Office for AA. It's 816-471-7229.
Thanks so much, Liz Henry.
Thank you, Lee.
Ready? 1, 2, 3. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's alright, that's okay, cause I'm gonna
make
my world
a better place.
Gonna keep
that smile
on
my face.
Yeah, I'm gonna teach.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. To find a link to audio of today's show, our calendar of events, and more, check out Jaws of Justice Radio on Facebook. To contact us, send an email to jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And to find out about future shows, check us out on KKFI's website, kkfi.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We thank our engineers, Joe Henderson and Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then, round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale. Today's outro theme music is Better Man from the Playing for Change Songs Around the World CD.
I'm gonna get back up. It'll be alright. It'll be okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Gonna keep that smile on my face. Gonna teach myself how to understand. Gonna make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following comes to us courtesy of WJZ, Maryland.
The candidate for governor wants to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Maryland.
Marriott comes from Democratic candidate Heather Mazier, and it would highly regulate the use of pot. She says it's time to decriminalize it. For the first time, a major party candidate for Maryland governor wants to open the door to legalize recreational marijuana use.
We will take the underground market that exists for everyone who's seeking access to this substance and bring it to the light of day.
Democratic delegate Heather Mazier says it would only be for those over 21, illegal to smoke in public. She wants to tax it $50 an ounce, bringing in, she says, as much as $157 million a year for education.
Drug dealers on the streets are still selling marijuana to children. They're not asking for an ID.
But critics, like former addict and counselor Mike Gimble, call the controversial proposal dangerous.
It is totally backwards, irresponsible, stupid, and it's going to hurt people, and nobody really seems to care.
A poll last month showed 51% of Marylanders support legalization, 40% oppose it.
I know for a fact lots of people smoke, so that's a lot of money going to the state.
For me, it's just putting temptation in the way of young people to have it legalized.
They're throwing people in jail for little amounts and ruining lives over little amounts of marijuana that's legalized in other places.
Maryland is surrounded by jurisdictions that have legalized medical marijuana, like D.C. and Delaware, and states considering doing so, like Pennsylvania and West Virginia.
Marijuana is a safer substance than even alcohol or tobacco.
It's going to be easier to smoke pot than it's going to be to smoke cigarettes.
The debate is going well beyond politics. And there are concerns about whether high taxes on the marijuana could create another underground market. Also, what the federal government would do. Under this proposal, drugged driving of any kind continues to be illegal. Kai?
That's a good point, Mike. Thank you. Now, what does the public think about this controversial proposal? Complete coverage continues right now with Jessica Cartaglia. She's live at cdsbaltimore.com. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Kai. So right now it does seem like Marylanders who responded to CBSBaltimore.com seem in favor of legalizing marijuana. In our online poll, we asked if marijuana should be legal here in Maryland. Right now, 92% of all people say yes, with just 8% saying no. People also tweeted us at CBS Baltimore. James says, I think it'd be very smart for the state to legalize marijuana. It would raise millions of dollars in revenue for the state. Amber tells us in a tweet, I don't think marijuana should be legalized anywhere. She goes on to say that we need to ban all tobacco and alcohol products.
Considering how well alcohol prohibition turned out and how well this drug war is going, it's amazing that some people just can't get enough. DeanBecker, DrugTruth.net.